I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday afternoon. Tonight's Frontline documentary on PBS is Separate and Unequal, an Omarina's Story. The East Baton Rouge Parish School District was forced to desegregate in 1981, but now a group of mostly white middle-class parents and business leaders are trying to break away from the district and form a new city with its own separate schools. Similar movements are taking place in other cities around the country. Kyle Spencer is with us this hour, co-producer and a reporter for tonight's PBS Frontline special. Kyle frequently is a New York Times contributor who's written for the New York Magazine, Slate, The Daily Beast, Baltimore Sun, International Herald Tribune, Miami Herald, The Washington Post, The Philadelphia Inquirer, and many other publications. In recent years, much of her reporting has focused on the impact of race and class inside American classrooms. The second part of tonight's documentary focuses on a very remarkable young woman, Omarina. She went to school in the Bronx and wasn't going to school very often, very difficult family situation, frequently absent, really struggling. And the school targeted students like her who were missing a lot of school or failing math or English and did intervention. And she became remarkably successful. She is now a sophomore in high school at a very prestigious high school. So it focuses on her story as well. We'll be welcoming phone calls during the course of this hour, 800-486-8655. It's been 60 years since Brown versus the Board of Education, when the Supreme Court declared separate schools for black and white children unconstitutional. Where do you think we are now? Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Hi, Kyle. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, how are you? I'm very glad to be here.
Yeah, great to have you with us. I had a chance to preview the shows over the weekend, and they are powerful and very, very provocative, very nicely done. My congratulations to you and everybody who worked on them.
Oh, thank you very much.
Well, let's talk about what's going on. East Baton Rouge Parish School District did desegregate in 1981, but this movement is very strong, and I can't help but believe that it's going to be successful to have a new district that is primarily white and much more affluent than Baton Rouge. They need signatures, don't they? But they're probably going to get them.
They do. The East Baton Rouge Power School District is a somewhat struggling district in Louisiana. It's had its ups and downs. It's got some wonderful schools. It's got some very, very trying schools. The attempt now, a small, rather large swath of the Baton Rouge area that had been part of the school district, mostly middle class, mostly white, have decided that they are really kind of done with being attached to the school district and want out. They are in the process of gathering signatures in order to take this particular decision to a vote in the community. And they, I think, have, they need 18,000. I think they're 1,000 short at this point. So it's up in the air. It's hard to know what will happen, but everybody is watching and paying lots of attention.
And the whole school district probably needs the money from this area, don't they, for the other schools? Because I assume schools are paid for via property taxes partially?
Yes. What happened with this particular breakaway is that originally it started as a small community, but it quickly grew. The folks who wanted to break away decided that they wanted to take with them the what is referred to as the Mall of Louisiana, which is a very large, piece of property, a tax base for the town and for the city of Baton Rouge. Once that happened, people got really worried because that could be a big hit to the school district.
One of the early interviews is with a mother who's raising four children and obviously has thought long and hard about the best educational experience for her children. Tell us her story and the story of her children.
Well, when we went to do the film, we really wanted to explore what it was that was motivating parents to want to split from the district, but then to really take that split to its logical conclusion. So we looked for a family that we thought would be most impacted and affected. We found Nikki Dangerfield, who is a really lovely woman. She has four children. She lives in inner city Baton Rouge. She's a single mom. And she has one daughter who is actually at LSU right now. That's Louisiana State University, and was a valedictorian. Then she has three boys. They're all in middle school. And she has taken full advantage of magnet programs in Baton Rouge and also busing, voluntary busing programs that now still exist there. One of the boys is extremely theatrical, and she has him in a wonderful theater program at a magnet middle school. Another one is a very, very bright student, and she has him in a gifted program. And finally, she has a son who struggles a bit and has some very specific needs, and he goes also to a local school that she feels really helps him. Her fear, her worry, her big concern is that if the breakaway happens, her choices will be shut down. Some of these wonderful programs won't exist anymore because this district won't have the money to provide them. And some of the schools that are in the area that are breaking away that have been appealing to her may actually no longer be ones that she can send the kids to.
Including the high school, which is Woodlawn High School, and one of her young sons who would like to go there.
Yeah. Woodlawn High School, which is the school that we chose to focus a great deal of attention on, is the one that has kind of caused the most controversy during this breakaway discussion in Baton Rouge. The school has attracted, it was originally an entirely white school that drew kids just from the particular neighborhood it's in, but for a variety of reasons, including voluntary busing and some shifts in neighborhood zoning, the school is now very diverse, and it's become a popular spot. It has a gifted program and a scholars program, which is basically like a gifted program. It's become a popular spot for families like Nikki's who are looking, frankly, to escape neighborhood schools, which are not good.
Mm-hmm. And the principal gets very emotional when you interview him about the future of Woodlawn. It seems as though he is very committed to make certain that all students, no matter what their background, have a really good education, and that he's in business to serve everybody.
Yeah, the principal, Daniels, who we spend quite a bit of time with when we're down there, is so poignant and passionate about his work with kids. And he wants to see all kids get a good education, and he says that pretty bluntly. The breakaway effort, I think he fears, is going to hinder that potentially. And I think the thing that we saw when we interviewed him was that Baton Rouge is a small town. It's like a lot of places where kids come to a school and the faculty comes to know them very well and comes to care deeply about them. And I think that what we saw with him, and frankly with other faculty members at that school, was a kind of just utter sadness that an opportunity might be lost for some of his students in the future.
You do extensive interviews with parents and business leaders who would like to break away. The group spokesperson saying, "We've had enough of failing our children. We're not going to do it anymore. We've got to go to the length of creating our own city, to create our own education system, to take control back from the status quo." Obviously, you can put race in the center of this, but would you say that they're reasons for wanting to break away are legitimate? They want their kids to have better education than what the city is offering.
Yeah, I think that's a really fair way to characterize their push here. I think that what we came to understand in talking to Norman Browning, who is this grandfather with two grandkids who he wanted to see in the public school system, but whose parents had left for a neighboring town because they didn't think the schools were good enough. He really feels like he's doing an honorable thing, that he is trying to create a school system, his own school system, and with these other families that will provide an opportunity for kids that they can't get in the Baton Rouge public school system. The schools are struggling in Baton Rouge. We were able to visit many of them. Some of them are wonderful schools. We saw some magnet schools that were just outstanding places, just diverse, high-performing, wonderful. We also saw schools that were not very good, that the test scores are low. I think 40% of the schools in Baton Rouge at this point, more than 40%, are receiving a D or an F from the state. So his arguments and his concerns about the Baton Rouge public school system not doing everything it can and not offering the best quality education to all kids is very legitimate.
And yet at one point they invite an African-American, I don't know if he's a minister or what, from the Tea Party, who tells them, you know, keep fighting. They may call you racist, but you know who you are and you're not racist. What was that all about?
Yeah, that was a funny little, it was a little bit of a quirky event, and it was, I think, fascinating. And it, first of all, it let us all view this as partially a race issue, but also very much a class issue. And although race and class in America are intrinsically linked, this was really, in many ways, a movement among middle-class families who just want, they feel that they've sort of paid out of the problems of the poor. And what this minister, very fiery, very dramatic in the film, says to these families who have come for a meeting, it happens in a church, but it's a community meeting, he says to them, make decisions based on your pocketbook. Do what's good for your pocketbook and don't let people call you out on it.
Mm-hmm. What about efforts in Baton Rouge? You mentioned those high-performing schools. What about efforts to replicate those high-performing schools? Is there an effort underway? Is that a lot easier said than done?
Well, one of the detractors, the leaders of the group that is fighting this movement the hardest, is a mom, Belinda Davis. She is a white, actually a professor at LSU. She has three children in the public school system, all of them in magnet schools. She, like some of the other families we spoke to, including Nikki Dangerfield, are huge advocates of the magnet programs, and they want to see these parents stop trying to break away and really invest in what is essentially programs that are that include voluntary busing around the district, but allow kids to go to schools that are often themed. So if a student is very interested in science, they might go to a science school. Some of the schools are bilingual. Some of them have an agriculture bent. This is what she would like to see. I think the problem with replicating that and the tragedy, I think, of that is that many families in Baton Rouge have two issues with the magnet school program. One, it requires a tremendous amount of transporting your kid in the morning.
Right.
And we saw that. We saw kids getting on buses the crack of dawn before sunup and then getting off the bus halfway to school in a parking lot, having to transfer to another bus, and the sun wasn't even up yet.
Oh, my.
It's a lot to ask. It's a lot to ask of families, and I think that was one that the breakaway folks are saying, we're not doing this anymore. And, you know, there is some legitimacy to how inconvenient and difficult that can be for kids.
Right.
But the other issue with the magnet programs in Baton Rouge is that they're generally calling students who are higher performers. You have to have a certain test score to get into them. So the breakaway folks are saying, well, what if my kid isn't gifted? So you're saying if my kid is gifted, my kid's a good test taker, they can go to a great magnet school. But if I don't have that kind of kid, I just have to kind of slog through a not-so-good school.
What happens to those magnet schools, Kyle, if the district is successful, St. George, in breaking away?
Well, that's a really great question, and it's something that we really investigated around and asked a lot of people and thought a lot about. What will happen, the principals of those magnet schools say, is that they're going to lose a huge amount, their middle-class white population, much of which comes from this area that wants to break away. So suddenly this kind of ideal mixing of students from different races and different classes that happens in these schools is going to cease to exist. And that is, I think, one of, you know, the biggest issues and problems with this potential breakaway.
Did you also work on Omarina's story?
I did not. I can speak to it a little bit and be happy to, but I was not one of the producers on it.
You know, talk about an inspirational story and targeting students in middle school to make sure that they can succeed. It's just you left that story thinking, boy, I wish everybody had such intervention programs to target kids who are absent all the time or who are failing because the circumstances in which they're living are so, so difficult. And some of them can be reached, so we don't have a huge number of young people dropping out of high school.
Yeah. The story about Omarina is just so touching. And my producer who worked on that story had actually already done a really lovely piece about Omarina when she was in a middle school, was struggling in the middle school in New York City. And it turned out that the school had this incredible program that is able to identify students when they are potentially at risk for dropping out. And what the program does is it shows indicators. It's aware of what indicators really tell school officials that a student may be at risk. Those indicators are often lower grades in English and math, and also problems with attendance, not showing up to school or being late. And what they did with Omarina was they caught it. They caught that she was struggling. They became very involved in assisting her. They have a wonderful counseling program at the school. And they were able to counsel her, to assist her. She was actually at some points homeless. They were able to help her figure out how to get to school. I think there's a wonderful scene in the first film that Mary did that's also on the Frontline website, which is just fabulous, a great way to explore the Omarina story is to see the first one and then to see the one that's airing tonight.
Mm-hmm.
There's wonderful scenes of the school officials sitting with her, going over subway maps. How are you going to get to school tomorrow?
Right. And she also has such a good heart. She's taking care of her brother who did not fare as well.
No, she does take care of her brother, and he is really, I think, the story of Omarina and her brother is a story about resilience. It turns out that Omarina is quite resilient and is able to take advantage of these incredible opportunities that come her way with these wonderful helpers and advisors, and he is not so able to take advantage, and folks can see the film and see, sadly, what happens to him, during the course of the piece that Mary has so artfully done.
Tonight on Frontline on PBS, check your listings to see what time it will be on in your area. Separate and Unequal and Omarina's Story. Separate and Unequal is focusing on the East Baton Rouge Parish School District that was formed to desegregate schools in 1981. But now there's a group of mostly white middle-class parents who want to break away from the district and form a new city with its own separate schools. St. George would be the name here. And it takes into account what's happening in Central City schools, how magnet schools have tried to get young people, mostly white people, into schools with African American students, how some students are in schools that are pretty miserable. But the focus of much of this is what's happened to this ideal of integrated education. It's been 60 years since Brown versus the Board of Education, Supreme Court saying separate schools for black and white children are unconstitutional. And where do we find ourselves in 2014, but with separate schools? So is it still an ideal? What do you think about it? I know you haven't seen the show. It'll be on tonight, but you get an outline of what it's about. And this is not unique to the East Baton Rouge Parish School District. Similar movements are taking place in cities around the country. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter @KDunnShow. Kyle Spencer is our guest, co-producer and reporter for tonight's PBS Frontline special. She concentrated on the East Baton Rouge Parish School District, but the other documentary she's also familiar with, Omarina's Story, which is a terrific story of inspiration. Obviously, when you're hearing what's going on here, there are similarities in school districts, large school districts in the state of Wisconsin, too. So the underlying question is, what can we do to make sure all students have really high-quality educations? What do we do? 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls. We're talking this hour about tonight's highly recommended Separate and Unequal and Omarina's Story. The Frontline special documentary is on PBS. Richard in Madison, our first caller. Hi, Richard.
Hi.
Hi.
I was wondering if you had read the report by Gordon Lafer, Do Poor Kids Deserve Lower Quality Education Than Rich Kids? Evaluating School Privatization Proposals in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Professor Lather's thesis is that public education is ripe to be taken over by corporate interests, privatization of schools, and that this is planned by ALEC and other corporate interests.
Kyle.
Yeah, I have not read that report. I am certainly familiar with the issues that surrounding the privatization, so to speak, of public schools. I think that there's definitely two sides of that story, but I do think that it's true that there is a tremendous amount of money to be made inside public schools today. I think part of that is through, charter schools, vouchers, and then also through the testing movement. There's lots of tests that need to happen. There's lots of test prep. There are lots of tests that have to happen, test prep, folks to provide all that, and that's a sizable amount of money that can be made.
Thank you, Richard, very much for the call, and that would be a pertinent question for our second hour guest today as well. Bob in Amherst Junction, hi.
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 Well, I guess I have a statement to make and then a question of your guest. The statement is that it seems to me that what's happening in East Baton Rouge might be a micro example of this larger Tea Party movement and privatization of schools, where there's this rejection of government.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe government in some cases has gotten too big. You mentioned how long it takes for some of these kids to get to school. But rather than reject government, because I really believe government is us, it might be just a matter of scale. And I'm wondering if some of these folks in East Baton Rouge could create a community that's diverse and not based on socioeconomic class and scale down to some degree where they can work together to create what they want, but not leave other people out. And maybe we can create smaller geographic communities. And I'm just wondering, is that something that's been discussed, or what do you think about that?
I think part of what's happening in Baton Rouge is a real the folks are very disenchanted with this large bureaucracy that is their school system. And I think that there are some legitimate issues there. Norman Browning, the father the grandfather that is the leader of the movement, and Lionel Rainey, who is the leader, sort of spokesperson for the movement, are constantly saying, we're fed up, we've given them enough chances. And what they're talking about is the fact that the East Baton Rouge public school system has struggled for years. It's underperforming, the students are not doing well on test scores, and they have repeatedly told the parents, we're going to make the schools better, we're going to make them better. And these parents are essentially saying, you know what, we've given up, just as this caller has said. They say, we've given up. We don't want to have this large bureaucracy trying to address these issues. We think we can do a better job. So I think that's one factor. I think this idea of having smaller districts is something that has been tried in the past. One of the problems with smaller districts, if you really want to have integrated socioeconomic and also racial schools, is that housing patterns are very families live in communities that are often very segregated, and so when you get into sort of micro school districts, the benefit is that you have these wonderful community schools, you have lots of walking to school, all great things. The problem with that can be that you can have very, very segregated schools.
So do you find in Baton Rouge that there are a lot of schools in Central City areas that are primarily African-American?
Yes. What we found, and I think sadly you find this all over the United States, the best neighborhood schools tend to be in middle-class neighborhoods, and the schools that struggle the most are tend to be the schools that are in low-income neighborhoods. There's lots of reasons that that may be the case. One of the things that we found when we were doing our story was some fabulous and really interesting research that's happened over the years. Started the first sort of iteration of it was a report that was released in the 1960s, the John Coleman. It was called the Coleman Report. And what that report showed was that poor kids need to be with middle-class kids. They need the influences of those middle-class families that tend to have more prestige, more power. They tend to be better educated. They tend to have more time and money to invest in local schools. Middle-class kids tend to come to school with larger vocabulary. They have more resources on the weekends and in their spare time. And it's really, really good, it turns out, for poor kids to have exposure to those middle-class kids. So this report, the John Coleman report, was then re-examined, restudied in the 80s, again in the 90s, now in the 2000s. There's been lots and lots of looking at this. And I think it's pretty much confirmed that the reason that these schools are so bad in poor neighborhoods is that these kids get isolated and really need exposure to middle-class families and kids and parents.
And on the other hand, it's probably a dandy idea to have middle-class kids be, have exposure to poor children.
Indeed, indeed. And I was actually just writing a print piece, which please everybody look at. Our Frontline has incredible multimedia stuff that they do. And so I'm working on a piece right now for the website that'll be up tonight. Had a fascinating interview with a professor at Columbia University who spoke just on that. She said, you know, when we look at schools, are they good, are they bad? We're in such an accountability era now that we tend to just look at test scores. Like, that must be a bad school because the test scores are low. That must be a good school because the test scores are high. But she said, maybe we ought to reconsider. Maybe we ought to be thinking about a good school as being a school that's incredibly diverse. And maybe we ought to sort of rethink how we evaluate a place that is going to prepare our children for the new world that we're entering, a global world, and a new country, a country that is increasingly diverse and really changing in that way.
Our number is 800-486-8655. We have some lines open, and we're talking about tonight's Frontline special, which examines the resurgence of school segregation in America. It looks specifically at the East Baton Rouge Parish School District in an attempt by a group of mostly white middle-class parents and business leaders to break away from the system and create a new city. And the question is, why would they feel they have to do that, and what does it do to the educational quality for the poor, mostly African-Americans, who are left behind? And is the idea, 60 years after Brown versus the Board of Education, a lot of people embrace the idea that diversity was a very good thing and that we should have racial mixture, we should have economic mixture of students. Do we still embrace that? Our number is 800-486-8655. Bob, thanks for your call. John in Appleton is next. Hi, John.
Hello, and thank you very much for your program.
You're welcome.
And for all the work you do. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
Yes, we can.
I can hardly hear you guys. Anyway, you're right on the right track with your report. As I was sharing with the screener, the June 2014 edition of the American School Board Journal, its cover story is on separate and unequal.
Oh, interesting. I'll have to look at that.
And there was even an article in our journal Sentinel on May 10th about this. Up here in Appleton, you know, we have a good public school system, and has a lot of partnerships that support it, the YMCA, Boys and Girls Club, to name a few. But I also wanted to throw into the mix the idea of supporting families with good paying jobs, and you know, the need for, in essence, unionized higher paying jobs than what currently exist in communities. Did you explore that at all in your piece about the economic stability of families with mm-hmm. with jobs and union with the unions and opportunities for people to get out of the lower economic class?
Yeah. Well, we what we did is we explored the economics of this story by first recognizing that the community, the St. George community that we had that was seeking to break away and that is still seeking to break away, I think we came to the story assuming, I mean, perfectly blunt, we kind of assumed, oh, this must be a really rich neighborhood. Oh, that's what must be going on here. And we came to realize very quickly that it was actually a very middle-class neighborhood and that families in the community had, to some extent, struggled in recent years. And many of their complaints about the school system were intrinsically linked to some of their economic struggles. They said that they were having a hard time selling their homes because young families didn't want to come into the community because it was attached to the school district that had a bad reputation. And they also said that they thought that there was not enough business and industry happening near their homes locally because, again, companies didn't want to come in. They weren't interested in having employees send their kids to that school. What we started to feel the more we talked to them was that rather than being these sort of mean, nasty people who are trying to stick it to the poor people of Baton Rouge, that they were actually feeling very stressed out about their children's opportunities, their own opportunities, and they had a sort of fatigue about things and were really motivated in that way.
And thank you very much, John, for your call. Our number is 800-486-8655. The two complement each other, the two documentaries, because you look at what the Mill School did, where Omarina in the Bronx, I can't remember the number mm-hmm. of the school, but looked at the model that they had for targeting students like Omarina, who was having a heck of a time getting to school, who had all of these horrible things happening at home. First time she saw her father, he was in a casket. I mean, all of this heavy, heavy burden to carry at a young age. But boy, did they intervene. And she found herself surrounded by people who cared about what she did. She counted on them. They helped her enormously. If we only had lots of resources to reach young people like that, maybe the school systems would be better.
Yeah, I think that's definitely the case. I think that that my discussions with Mary, who produced that episode, and also in watching the first one and part of this one that we are all going to see tonight, I guess Kathleen, it's what time is it in your neck of the woods?
We're in Central Time, so it's probably at 9 our time.
9, right, okay. Right. So essentially, what I think what you found there was a little oasis, and I think you see that. I think we all know that. There's some schools that are just oases. There are pockets. They
right.
have incredible principals who just stay there all the time and teachers, and that's what Omarina was benefiting from.
Mm-hmm.
That can be hard to replicate, I think, because it can be so staff-driven. But I think ideally, particularly with programs like the one that you see in that film, if schools can really get behind a program that they know works, then maybe people can take staff members and principals and can take the time and the effort to really guide students in that way.
Lois in Eau Claire, hi.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
Yes, I have an idea about how to improve the Milwaukee public schools, the inner city.
Oh, great.
And that is, I'm a retired public school teacher in Wisconsin. I taught 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
And that is to pay one of the parents to go to school and pay the child to go to school in the inner city in Milwaukee, because oftentimes the parents are receiving some kind of assistance anyway. And then they would be accountable, the parent and the child, for each other to show up at school and want to do well. I think that's a way that some kind of action needs to be taken to help families. I agree with the previous caller, economic stability is so key.
Mm-hmm.
For these neighborhoods.
I'm not understanding. So the parents should go to school with the child?
Yes. Many of the parents in the inner city, from my studies, dropped out of school themselves to break the cycle of people not going to school, then perhaps the parent would like to finish their education along with the child, that would break the cycle of people not going to school.
Mm-hmm.
It's just an idea I have.
Thank you for your call, Lois. Kyle?
I think it's really interesting, Lois. I don't know how that would work exactly, but I think it is interesting. I do know that some schools, some schools in New York City, and I probably assume across the country, have really returned to these ideas of offering what are often referred to as wraparound services, which means that a school, and particularly in a troubled neighborhood or a very low-income neighborhood, might offer dental care, might offer resume building for parents. And so that could actually fit quite well into that model. Maybe there's literacy classes at night for parents. And that model is really something that there's been a lot of interest in that, this idea that schools in these poorer neighborhoods might need to actually become more community centers and provide these lots and lots of services to the families that send their children there.
Thanks very much, Lois, for your call. Pat in Brookfield, hi.
Hi, I'm looking forward
to
watching the show tonight. I've been a teacher for 37 years.
You'll like
it. Great.
Yeah,
and but I would like to bring up a point. You know, it seems like this is going on in every city and state all over this country, the same similar types of things that are pretty much destroying public education. And I agree with one of the previous callers that this is another example of the American Legislative Council, or ALEC's, plan to pretty much, you know, shut out public schools by allowing hedge fund managers and Wall Street people to start all these schools and then set the policies. And, you know, the educators are being pushed out of the decision-making.
Is that happening in Baton Rouge? Are some of the central city schools becoming charter schools or schools, mm-hmm. private schools that are run? There are a lot of those. Mm-hmm. And they're all over the country. Yeah, they are.
Yeah. What you're seeing in Baton Rouge, I think you're seeing it all over the country, is the closing of poor-performing schools.
Mm-hmm.
And the state, Louisiana, has the State Department of Education has taken them over. And so at this point, I think there are about a dozen schools in the East Baton Rouge Power School District that are now run by the state. And what that means, the state superintendent John White, who many people may know because he's responsible for the charter schools that have opened in New Orleans. He's a big charter advocate. So what it means when a school gets taken over by the state in Louisiana, it really pretty much means it's going to turn into a charter.
But I would imagine that the school in what may become St. George would not be charter schools, or would it
No,
be?
Yeah. No. There doesn't seem to be much interest in that. I mean, I think what the folks in this particular area that want to break away, what they really want is local control, and they refer to that a lot. They want community schools. They want local control. They want to be able to have really the programs that they want. They don't want to have to negotiate with a bureaucracy downtown. If they want arts, if they want computer programs, if they want more advanced placement classes, they kind of make it happen themselves. And so I think the idea of having a charter would be kind of anathema. It would really kind of defeat the purpose. They want to be running the schools themselves.
Tonight, Frontline, 9 o'clock, you will find it on PBS, Separate and Unequal, and Omarina's Story. Kyle Spencer is with us, co-producer of the Separate and Unequal documentary, where they went to the East Baton Rouge Parish School District, where there's a lot going on, an attempt to form a new city, really, to have a separate set of schools, because those people, and they're mostly white families, say they have had enough of failing our children. They're not going to do it anymore, and they'll go to the length of creating their own school. Those who are opposed to the creation of this new city say that the spokesperson, Belinda Davis, you're automatically going to be creating a city that is less diverse than the one you're leaving, and it'll take away resources, and that's not fair to the children who remain behind. We're welcoming phone calls. Our number, this is not peculiar, of course, to Baton Rouge, the East Baton Rouge district. It's fairly common in what's going on in many other cities in the country. What do you think? How do we educate everybody? Well, 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. And we're on Facebook. Leave messages there. It would be really nice if you could think about this, is to watch the show tonight and then leave messages after you've seen the show so that we can continue a dialogue on our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Just a thought. So more phone calls momentarily on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, Dave in Milwaukee is next. Hello, Dave.
Hi. I guess I had a question and a comment. My question is, I keep hearing about the segregation of this school, and I understand the social economic point of view, but, I mean, are they saying there's no colored kids allowed there? I mean, if somebody could and wanted to and was financially able to, would anybody be able to send their children there? And then my comment is that all across the country on a whole, from elementary school to universities, our public education system is faltering at best. Last I saw, we were ranked 17th in the world. And if we want to consider ourselves a global leader, that can't remain the same.
We
need to do something about our public education system, and maybe privatization and allowing a board or a panel of parents and advisors to set the curriculum for what works in their area rather than a federal national system would be a better way to go.
Don't you think, though, that Wisconsin on the whole has had a pretty good public education system, Dave?
On a whole, compared to other points, places in our country, I would agree with that. On a whole, compared to the rest of the world, no. No.
Kyle, what do you say?
Well, I mean, I think that we are all looking at other countries and asking ourselves, how are we faring? And a lot of times what we're discovering, it can be disappointing. I know that in recent years, the PISA study, which is a international study that clocks how American public school students do compared to students in China and Finland and all over the world, we are frequently rated mid to low, with countries, students in Beijing, Shanghai, Finland, some other Asian countries, Japan, Korea, doing better, much better in math, literacy skills, in analytical thinking, science. I think that we really have to ask ourselves whether over the years our standards have leveled off or even gone down. And so I think this concern, at least with this PISA exam, is telling us we're not competing in the same kind of field that these other countries are.
Thanks, Dave. Let's go to Judith in Maguanago. Hi, Judith.
Hi.
Hi, Judith.
Thanks for taking my call. I'm going to be perfectly blunt, and I'm sure you're not going to be happy with me, but I'm middle class. I'm tired of being blamed for the schools failing, for my desire to have my kids get the best education. I have a question also. Mm-hmm. Has anyone ever looked into these schools that are integrated, that we bus and spend bazillion dollars for? Has the education gone down since the integration? And if so, I can see why those people are trying to get their own system. I paid for my child's education, and now I am to pay for everyone else's education coming in, and we hold no one responsible. I'll tell you a sure way to get those kids to school. Take away some of the welfare money every time they miss school. I'm telling you, those schools will be jammed, packed.
That's what you have to say. All right, Kyle, take it on.
Well, first of all, I'm not sure that taking away people's welfare money would actually get their kids to school. I think a lot of times people who are on welfare have lots of challenges that make it really difficult for them to do a lot of things, and probably getting their kids to school is one of them. But I'd also say that to this caller, that you are frustrated with your public school system. This is something that these families felt acutely, and we were, frankly, as documentarians, incredibly sympathetic. We saw a school system which had in many ways failed these parents. And I think one of the things that we're all discovering as we sort of look back on the 60th anniversary of Bound versus Board of Education is that the busing efforts were not good for a lot of people, black and white, that they did in many cases send kids bused around districts and did not, and oftentimes to schools that were not so great, and in some cases actually schools that began to deteriorate. Now, in filming this we found that African Americans and white researchers all were looking back at DSEG orders and saying, that didn't work so well. One of the things that happened was lots of white flight. Whites left public schools in record numbers, and it really hurt the school districts. And in other cases, the busing was very haphazardly done for lots of reasons. So now we're looking at these districts that have been sort of bruised and beaten up to some extent, and that parents are in this world that we're living in, increasingly competitive, saying, I'm sick of worrying about other people's kids. My school district has failed me. I just want to worry about my own kid. You know, it's a very understandable position to be in and for them to feel that they're in. It just is. It's understandable.
And I feel it necessary just to say something here because this issue is near and dear to me, but it would seem to me as though Judith needs to look at how other people are living. I mean, this idea that kids who are, you know, coming from all the families are on welfare, it simply isn't true. There are mixtures in our city schools, and all of our kids went to MPS school. So there are mixtures of kids who come from very poor families, and their families are working hard to make a buck, for heaven's sake. They're not sitting around on welfare, for heaven's sake. And this idea, if you go to an integrated school, your scores are going to go down. I mean, some of the best schools in the state are in MPS that are very integrated schools and probably the optimal educational experience in terms of diversity in all areas and terrific teachers. And I mean, the best can happen here in addition to the worst, but it doesn't have to do with, you know, people sitting around on welfare and get them to, you know, it just, you need to understand and walk a mile in somebody else's shoes.
Yeah, and I think that in Baton Rouge and in other parts of the country where these middle-class communities are trying to separate from these poorer communities of color, I think that's really the rub. The rub is, we feel your pain, but are you feeling the pain of your neighbors and your community members? Are you seeing your community as a larger
as
whole?
A whole.
Or are you
exactly.
seeing it as just your family?
Exactly, yeah. John in Madison, maybe our last caller. We might have time for one more. Hi, John.
Hi, John.
Oh, are you talking? Am I on?
Yes, you are.
I wanted to answer your question. Like, how do we educate everyone equally? My thought for, you know, having gone through high school and college, the college campus offers so many different things for people to do. And my high school was similar to that. Yet at the same time, attending high school is almost dismal if you have no hope of going to college. Whereas if you have an alternative curriculum that you could choose, as in to go to an apprenticeship program to become a skilled laborer, it almost would make it more viable to go to school, give you that motivation. And I kind of put everyone on an equal playing field, because not everyone needs the same education, even though there are certain things everyone should know.
Kyle.
Sorry, I guess I'm wondering, more options in schooling?
All right.
So your question is, do we need more options? Do you mean like some students might be college-bound and some
yes.
are not?
Yeah, take it that way.
Okay, yeah. I think that's, I write about education in New York City. There's a big push in New York City to do that type of thing, to have high schools which send some kids off to four-year colleges, but to also understand that not everybody needs to be college-bound. Somebody might go to an associate college, get a community college, get an associate's degree. Other people may want to go into a trade. I think that was a very unpopular consideration for the last 10 or so years, and I think there's a kind of return to that maybe we ought to be thinking more broadly.
Oh, there are so many issues here, aren't there, Kyle? Oh,
yeah.
There are so many issues. Well, they're very well done. It's fair, I think, to everybody involved in this, the documentary, and extremely provocative, and Omarina's story is one that everybody should see just to be inspired. She's quite a young lady. And thank you for being with us.
Oh, well, thank you so much. This has been an absolute pleasure.
Great. Thanks. Kyle Spencer, our guest this hour, co-producer and reporter. The documentary is on tonight. It's Frontline. It's Separate and Unequal, and it's followed by Omarina's story, and it's very worthwhile. Leave messages on our Facebook page, or after you see the documentary, I'm wondering what you think. about it so you can leave messages. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour and to Lisa Nalbandian for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. We have news coming up in a moment, and part of our conversation next hour will center on schools as well, all the charter schools in New Orleans.